Good evening, everyone. This is Catherine Austin Fitz. I'm your host tonight for Building Real Wealth with our special guest, Franklin Sanders of the Money Changer. Franklin is a precious metals dealer and a farmer in Tennessee, a couple hours down the road from me. He's been our special guest on our precious metal series. We interviewed him for investing in silver and gold coins, and he's a very, very special friend. He publishes the Money Changer newsletter, which I read regularly. His scorecard, the Money Changer Silver and Gold Report, is one of the rare newsletter emails I always read. We're going to be talking about building real wealth as a follow-up to navigating the falling dollar and understanding more the notion of using money as a power tool or using your financial resources as a power tool to both build financial wealth, but really to build your world. And no one is a better commentator and explainer and teacher of that I know than Franklin Sanders. We're going to be talking for about an hour, and then we're going to take questions and answers. There is a link on your event resource page, and I would encourage you to follow that link and post questions at the Solari Action Forum where it will take you. If you listen to this after it's recorded, we will continue to endeavor to respond to questions over time, so I would encourage you to post your questions. So we'll be talking for about an hour and then have questions for about 12 minutes. Franklin?
Yes, ma'am.
Good evening.
Good evening.
Good evening. So wealth, our favorite, this is a topic that you and I truly love. Wealth versus money, Franklin. Tell us what the difference is between wealth and money and how we should start to think of wealth versus money.
Before the invention of money, before the invention of coinage, when people thought of wealth, they thought of more goats, more sheep, more cattle, more orchards, more vineyards, all of those productive assets that continue to create something that you can use. And about the beginning of the 7th century B.C., in Asia Minor, they invented coinage. Until that time, almost every economic transaction, well, every economic transaction had to be carried out by barter. That is, if you had goats and you wanted wine, we had to agree how many goats were worth a jug of wine and that sort of thing. When they used silver and gold, they actually used little ingots. They were not the same weight. Every time they were used, they had to be weighed out. And the Lydians in Asia Minor suddenly had the idea that had not occurred to anyone else before. Why don't we make these things in little discs and stamp the weight and fineness on them by the state and let the state certify that this is good. And when they did that, that created this revolution. Well, the Americans of their day, I guess you could say, or the technology nuts of their day were the Greeks. And they adopted anything new that came along. And they very quickly understood what money could do and how they could use it. But they didn't really understand the profound difference that it could make in their society, the profound change that it could cause to come about. Because if you think about it, a person who's concentrating on wealth is a producer. But a person who's concentrating on money or money profits is really a speculator. Maybe he's a middleman, but basically he's a speculator. And it's a completely different mentality. And the effect that money has on society and on the way we think and the values that we adopt is extremely profound. I mean, it goes right down to the roots of society. And what the Greeks found out within a very short time, within about 200 years, was that money could be used as a power tool to enslave a people, an economy. The Greek farmers actually, they would go to borrow money, and now, because of the invention of coinage, this whole business of borrowing and lending was facilitated, and they did so at very high interest rates. Well, one of the things that they could pledge was not only their land, but also their wives and children. And if they defaulted on the debt, then they had to cough up their wives and children who went into slavery. And literally the whole of Athenian society was threatened. All of the productive members of society were threatened to become the slaves, very literally the slaves. We're not talking in metaphorical terms. Very literally the slaves of those few people who had amassed most of the money and who were the money lenders in Athenian society. So along comes Solon, the great lawmaker, and he saw what had happened, and he instituted what was called the shaking off of burdens, and actually, you know, said no more. You can't pledge your wife and children for debts. You can't pledge land, and he just wiped out the debt. The reason I'm telling this story is not because it's just interesting to historians, but because the same very same thing has happened to us. And when a society or a people concentrates on money profits alone, then they don't concentrate on wealth and wealth production.
Right.
And it's not the same thing. It's not the same thing at all. It's the productive mentality, the producer's mentality versus the speculator's or gambler's mentality. And I think most people in American society don't realize that. They have been taught to think that the important thing is to make money profits. Whereas,
and it's hard to tell the difference.
Well, it is hard to tell the difference, but, you know, the money profit by and large, not altogether, but in a huge amount, the money profit is based on the federal credit. And this is something that you've talked about quite a bit, the assumption that the federal credit is going to be there. And that really is a speculation. It's a gamble because
right.
the federal credit, as you know and I know, is bankrupt. There isn't any federal credit. It's a confidence game that holds together simply as long as people have confidence in it. But I think if we want to get out of that system, if we recognize the vulnerability and fragility of that system, and also that if we recognize that system is parasitic, it is the tapeworm, and we don't want to be part of the tapeworm. We want to be part of a productive society. Then we're going to have to make some profound changes in the way we use our money. Because the money
I should probably
too.
Mention for those who haven't heard an audio seminar before that the tapeworm is our nickname for an economy that is a parasite. So it's what I call the negative return on economy. And so the parasite tapeworm is a parasite that drains its host. So we describe the current, you and I are talking about the financial system as it's currently constructed as a tapeworm.
Right.
Right. Well, what are some of the key principles to building wealth? Let's say I'm a member of the Solari Action Network and I'm trying to understand, okay, well, what do I do? How do I do it? What are some of the key principles of building wealth?
Well, I think, you know, the first one is service, and that sounds like a sort of a sanctimonious answer, but it's not. It's actually a very, very practical answer. How do you get people to give you their money? You serve them in some way. You
right.
give them something that they really need. Well, you know, you might counter, well, the cocaine dealer serves his customers, but he's serving them with something that destroys their lives. So that's quite a different thing. But I think the fundamental principle that you have to realize is that if you serve other people, then wealth, you're going to build wealth. The point, you know, as I thought about this wealth versus money, one of the things that seemed to jump out at me was that most people look for their security in a pile of money. And you and I both know, Catherine, that a pile of money, even what seem to be the most solid assets, can disappear overnight. I mean,
yes,
what about
it can.
All those people who worked for Enron and they had huge retirement accounts that were filled with Enron stock?
Right.
One day it was worth thousands of dollars, hundreds of thousands of dollars, and the next day it was worth nothing.
Right.
But all of those people who worked for Enron, who were actually productive people, who knew how to go into any situation and organize the human beings there to serve other people, who knew how to serve other people themselves, all of those people could go out the next day and find some kind of work to do so that they would continue to be able to make a living. The point I'm trying to make is that the capital you have in yourself is the greatest capital that you've got. That's the greatest security that you've got. It's the greatest wealth that you have. So what you ought to do first, you know, people, when when they think of investing, they think, oh, I've got to go to some investment counselor and I've got to send my money off to New York or London or someplace because I can't do that myself. Well, that's exactly wrong. You need to invest in yourself first. You know, for instance, with small businesses, and when I say small businesses, that doesn't mean, you know, a dry cleaner necessarily. It might be a manufacturing plant that has sales of $15 to $20 million a year. A small business makes a more consistent, higher profit than any other thing you can do in the United States. It makes about 20%. The return is about 20% a year. So your own business in your own locale is by far the most lucrative investment you can make. And it's very hard. You know that it's very, very hard to find something that year in, year out returns 20% on your investment. Very, very difficult.
One of the reasons I wanted to move to Tennessee is I wanted to live in a place where people really know how to do things.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm always amazed at, you know, anybody in Hickory Valley who knows how to cut glass or do the plumbing or the electricity or drive a truck or do a farm, you know, they're always needed, they're always useful, they're always important to their neighbors. But they've invested a lot of time and effort in learning a series of different trades which are useful.
Right, but that's wealth. They've been building wealth in themselves. Now, obviously you can build wealth outside of yourself, too, as you accumulate productive assets. But you see that's a different way of looking at the world than the way of looking at the world that says, well, how can I make just money profits out of this? How can I, you know, make this one raid into the market, make some money, and then take my profits and run with it? There's a different view of permanence and continuity that goes with it, too. Let me give you an example of what I mean by wealth versus money profits, and I think it really shows it. I have a dear friend who came from central Mississippi, and if you, in, you know, 40 years ago, 50 years ago, if you went to that part of the country, it was some of the poorest country in the world because it had all been burned out and destroyed in the war between the states, and it had never recovered. And her grandfather had come to that area and started a little bank in the 1880s. And then he had two sons, and they carried on his work. Well, what they did was they looked for businesses to invest in. They did not loan money to businesses. When they saw a business that they liked, they would invest their own money in that business. They invested in chicken farms and chicken packing plants and lumber yards and timber operations, all of those things that would produce something around them, build up the local economy. And of course, they were looking for a profit. I mean, they weren't just, you know, altruistic souls, but they invested in these things in the mid-60s, the 50s and the 60s. And by the time they died, they had about a dozen grandchildren. And those investments, just in one of those enterprises, were worth over $100,000 per descendant. So, see, what they had done was they had made everyone in their local community rich by their concentration on wealth instead of money profits, because when they invested in a company, they didn't expect to take any money out of it for 5 years, 10 years, 20 years, maybe not even in their lifetime. But they were constantly building up wealth.
Right. It's the equivalent of local venture capital. That's
right.
What they were doing.
Right. Well, it seems like to me that that's exactly what you're thinking about with the Solari circles.
Right. I call it diamonds in your own backyard.
Right.
Because it takes seeing that which is really, I call it magical, about the people and the immediate opportunities around you. You know, and one of the things I find is that folks tend to think of investment as something very sophisticated and magical that happens someplace else that we can't understand.
Mm-hmm.
And that which is mundane and around us and we can understand or sort of part of the basic day-to-day flow of life doesn't have the same sort of magical investment opportunity. And that's not true. I mean, if you look at the numbers, as you said, it's just not true.
But, you know, you said something before we began this session in an earlier conversation. You quoted John Edward Hurley, culture is the integration of the divine in everyday life. And, you know, I love that statement because what it implies is that you look at the world around you with wonder. And I think that when you go to invest locally, you have to look around at the world around you with wonder. You have to see something deeper than just the everyday and the mundane. You have to see the opportunities that are there, and you also have to see the risks that are there.
Well, one of the things is we've been taught that liquid investments are safe and illiquid investments are not safe. You'll hear me talk about how a small business profits translates into 1 to 5 multiple times equity, mm-hmm. whereas a liquid company translates into a multiple of, 10 or 20 or 30 times. And a lot of the value is that liquidity.
Mm-hmm.
And so part of what we're talking about is Enron was a highly liquid investment.
Right.
When it crashed to a dollar, you could sell it quickly for a dollar and you could see the price. But we're talking about looking at the world of what is currently illiquid and learning about how to act and think and invest in that world.
Well, you mean in the local world,
in
the world around you. Yeah.
Right.
Well, you have to learn to trust your neighbors. You know, again, when we talk about the difference between wealth...
Or you need to learn which neighbors are trustworthy.
Well, that's exactly right. You point out one of the big differences in investing locally is not that you have to learn who you can trust with your money, but you have to learn who you can trust with your life.
In
other words, you're building... There's a different human relation that goes on. There's a difference of trust and friendship that goes much, much deeper... Because what you're doing is you're working together to build wealth. You have a common interest, and you have to have a common love for each other. You have to have community, if not family, and a common commitment to community. That is that, you're going to be here, and because you're going to be here, you're going to make it a better place to live. You have a portfolio that you're a case study portfolio. Would you like to go over that?
Yeah, I'd love to go over that. We, a group of us started a Solaria Investor Circle on the phone, mm-hmm. and what we decided to do first was to simulate a portfolio. It was to help each one of us understand what I call portfolio strategy, what to do with our own assets. And because everybody was different, we thought we'd put together a sort of a global portfolio.
Mm-hmm.
And what we did is we took a family of four, and we said, okay, we have a couple. We'll call them Gail, who's an accountant who works part-time, and George, who's an engineer. They're in their 40s. And arbitrarily, we said, they can earn $75,000 of income wherever they are, doing what they do. And they have two kids who are teenagers, Deborah and Dave. And we said, we're going to make them homeless. So we're going to have to pick out a place to live in a home. And we're going to give them total assets of $1 million.
Mm-hmm.
And we divided the portfolio into four parts. One was a local liquid portfolio,
mm-hmm.
which was $220,000 that was in precious metals, which we described as in honor of Franklin Sanders buried rather than put in the safe deposit. We buried it. We buried it in the backyard. Cash and deposits in a local bank, both checking accounts and CDs.
Mm-hmm.
We put 343 in what we called local non-liquid,
mm-hmm.
Which is home and then a lot of energy improvements. We wanted to be energy self-sufficient.
Mm-hmm.
But then we said this, they're going to do a circle locally, and so they're going to do local investment, whether it's land and real estate or mortgages and loans. We've been looking for where we're going to buy our home and plop down. And a lot of the decision of where do I want to live and who do I want to share my life with comes down to, what community and place would I like to also invest in.
Mm-hmm.
So we're looking at a place not just as where we live, but where we are committed to investing in and is attractive to invest. And then the third portfolio is Global Liquid, which is $375,000, which is investment in liquid securities and non-U.S. currencies. We've got got securities in non-U.S. currencies because of the risk of the falling dollar. And then a small amount, $62,000 in global non-liquid, which is really land abroad. And so what we've been doing is managing the investment in this portfolio and comparing, you know, how can we invest globally versus how can we invest locally, and trying to understand the different risk issues involved. Over time, what we're realizing is our best investment opportunities are local, but they also take an extraordinary investment of time and effort to learn both sort of about the local economy and to get to know who's who and to understand, you know, as you were talking about the two brothers, how to handhold and do that investment. So the local non-liquid has the greatest opportunity in many respects, but it's also the one that takes the most investment of our time.
Don't you think that's one of the, I mean, I hate to say it's laziness, but I think one of the problems that Americans face when they go to invest is that they've been taught the wrong thing. They've been taught that you can pass the responsibility for your own life over to somebody else. And, of course, you and I both know you can't ever do that. You know, the responsibility of it always comes back to you. And maybe they don't want to take the time. They're not ready to take the time to learn the things you said. Who's trustworthy? What's the local economy like? What are the opportunities and so forth? But the fact is that, you know, profit and building wealth can never be separated from effort.
Right.
There isn't any effortless way to grow
rich.
And
it can never be separated from learning.
Right. And if you think that you can just, you know, send your money off to XYZ management firm and you're going to get more than a, you know, minimal return, you're just wrong, because the people who do the work are the ones who are going to take the money. So,
you know, I was in litigation for a long, long time, and so it wasn't until last year that I started to learn from folks what their experience had been in the investment community. And Franklin, I was stunned at the extraordinary corruption just of the financial system and the, you know, sort of the draining of their different investment portfolios, or the complete yaya that they were investing in. I mean, you'll find folks who, you know, are putting their money into a socially responsible investment fund, and if you look at what's in it, it's basically all the corporations that are destroying and wiping out their community. It's astonishing. We're going to do an audio seminar later this summer called Beyond Socially Responsible Investment, when we're going to get into those issues. But it's, you know, it's just amazing. Or, you know, you see folks who are invested in things that they really, you know, they just don't understand.
Well,
so it's pretty amazing the state to which things have gotten in.
Well, you know, it's sort of legendary in the investment world that the very worst thing you can possibly do with your money is to turn it over to a bank trust department.
Right.
Very worst thing you can do. And, you know, the fact is that professional investment managers manage according to what they want and what's good for them, not necessarily what's good for you. And again, they're pursuing money profits. That's they want the bottom line result, and they're not as much concerned about building wealth. We have to keep going back to this. It's not the same thing. A money profit and building wealth is not the same thing, because when you build wealth, you build productive capacity that's going to keep on throwing off revenue. That's going to, you know, think of it as blessing. You know, it's like a fountain that keeps flowing and flowing and throwing off blessing to the people around you. So,
what was your example about the lambs the other day? Was it sheep?
Mm-hmm.
You bought, I can't remember the number. You bought 10 sheep.
Yeah, we bought about 10, and that was, I think, 2 years ago, and we've got 40 now. And they're out there now while we're talking, out there busy making more lambs for us. But I think what your listeners have to ask is, how do I translate this into my own life? How do I free myself from all these people who have positioned themselves as the intermediaries for my money? How do I take my money back and use it to create wealth, how do I invest locally? What things should I stay out of? What are the traps that are in front of me?
One of the things I realized the other day, I was looking at a portfolio, and I know you and I discussed this earlier, where there were three categories of assets. You had bank CDs was one category of assets. Then you had a group of debt securities, Ginnie Mae's and U.S. Treasuries. And then you had a group of corporate securities. And in each case, Franklin, the value of those securities was completely determined by the federal credit. So the bank CDs had FDIC insurance, and the investor was thinking that they were very secure because they were guaranteed by the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, which is a government federal entity. And they were looking at the Ginnie Mae securities, which have full faith of the U.S. Treasury, full faith and credit, and U.S. Treasuries, and they were thinking that those were very secure. And then if you look through the different mutual funds and into the corporations, they were all corporations who were highly dependent on government contracts and government programs for their profits. And so here is a portfolio that looked highly diversified and very conservative. And yet what you realized was this entire portfolio is highly dependent on the U.S. federal credit. And if that credit should be recognized as being bankrupt, which as an economic matter it certainly is, you know, this portfolio could be almost worthless.
But let's go back to something you just said. If you ask any investment advisor and so forth, they would say, well, what do you think? The federal government's going to go bankrupt?
Right.
That is exactly what you are saying. You see, that assumption, that presupposition that the federal credit will always be good is the one that undergirds all the investment decisions that all the investment advisors in the whole country make. I mean, it is practically the same thing as the prudent man rule. You know what the prudent man rule is.
Yeah.
That the performance of an investment advisor or someone with a fiduciary relationship is, did he do what a prudent man would do? And the foundation of that is that the federal credit is good, that the federal government is never going to go bust. Well, but the fact is, and you know this, and I know this, that the federal government is by definition bankrupt. The federal credit is by definition bankrupt because there's nothing behind what they do. There's nothing behind all of those guarantees. I mean, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac are the perfect example of that. What they've done is they've pumped up an enormous bubble. They have bought all of these mortgages that are, heaven knows how many of them are good, but a large percentage of them are not. They've driven down the traditional required down payments in real estate from 20% down to zero. And they've created a world where it's almost an insult to ask anybody if he can actually pay the mortgage that he wants. And this is typical of what happens whenever the federal credit enters into any area of business. You can look at the same thing with farming. You know, most big farmers in the country depend on federal subsidies.
Right.
I know some up in northwest Tennessee, and these fellows, it's a fella and his father, they are great farmers. These are, you know, multi-generational farmers. They have all the equipment. They use all the latest techniques. They use all the chemicals and so forth, and they farm about 2,000 acres and have a huge production. And he admitted to me, he said, you know, without the subsidies, we can't make it.
Right.
Now, these are people who are running probably $1 million a year operation, and they're telling me without the federal credit, they can't make it. So what?
Right, although if the federal credit pulled out of the system, they probably could.
Well, they would
probably
to
be in a market that then they could.
Right, they would have to completely restructure their operation to do
exactly
that.
Exactly.
To become productive. What they're telling you is that the federal credit, by creeping into farming and taking over farming and crowding out all other methods of financing and all other ways of thinking, has made them actually unproductive.
Right.
Does that make any sense at all? I mean,
well, sure. If you're running a centralized system and you want to control it, makes total sense.
Right.
The challenge,
those people now are dependent on the federal credit.
Right. The conundrum. the conundrum, if you looked at and you scratch through and you say, well, how does this crazy cuckoo system keep going? What you discover is it keeps going, Franklin, because the U.S. military is keeping it going. In other words, when the administration says we reserve the right to drop a nuclear bomb on you proactively, what I'm assuming is they're saying is if you don't buy more U.S. Treasury securities and use our currency, we reserve the right to drop a bomb on you. In other words, we have the complete synthesis of military warfare with economic warfare, and so what's keeping the dollar up and what's keeping the system going is the willingness of people around the world to take more dollars and take more U.S. Treasury securities, and that stops the minute we stop holding a gun to their head. And so if I'm investing in bank CDs and Ginny Mae's and Treasuries and Fannie Mae's, and I'm depending on those to continue to protect my financial wealth, what I'm depending on is the very military machinery that is, I say is destroying my world, whether it's destroying my world environmentally or politically or spiritually. So I'm betting on the dirty money in the military machine to keep playing the same game.
That is the game.
Right.
That is the game. You know, as you were speaking, I was thinking about the difference between that and a productive mentality. The reason that I'm trying to emphasize this difference between wealth and money is to show people that security is actually much greater when you're trying to build productive wealth than it is when you're trying to get money profits. You know, did I ever tell you the story about Jiffy Mix?
No.
Well, Jiffy Mix is like Bisquick, okay?
Uh-huh.
It's one of those biscuit pastry mixes that you can buy that's already in a box. And my wife likes Jiffy Mix better than anything else. Susan says it's the greatest thing going. So I was looking at the box, and on the side of the box it says founded in 1932. And I looked at that and I thought, 1932? Those people must have been completely lunatic to think that they could go into a business in the depth of the Depression, a business that actually was offering a more expensive convenience to people than just taking flour and lard and milk and mixing them together. And yet they went into business in the depth of the Depression, producing something that people could use and people wanted. And here we are 70 years later, and they're still doing it. So you see, their security, they understood. I mean, I don't know anything about the company other than that, but it's obvious that they understood that their security was in being productive. Their security
right.
was in serving the public. And so they're still here. And they
you know, it's interesting. I went back a couple years ago when I finally realized the Federal Credit was bankrupt, and I said, well, who made money during the Depression?
Mm-hmm.
And who started businesses during the Depression that has stood this test of time? And it's a fascinating experience, because what you discover is, you know, there were a lot of people during the last Depression or during the Great Depression who really did, sort of opportunistically use that period to really build incredible wealth. It can be done. That's a perfect example.
But they didn't do it at anybody's expense. I mean,
oh, no. They did it by getting fundamental productivity going in a variety of things. One of the great stories is Encyclopedia Britannica said, you know, everybody's out of the work. Now's our chance to build, you know, an incredible workforce.
Right.
And hired up a lot of incredibly amazing, talented people who stayed after the Great Depression was over. They were loyal and stayed throughout their career with the company.
Right.
And it really made Encyclopedia Britannica, is the story I was told.
Well, you know, that's one of the points that I like to make to people who have contemplated economic crash way too long. you know people like what I'm talking about. They've
right.
for the last 30 years or 60 years, they've expected the Great Depression to occur again. And certainly there's every reason to not to have faith in the present financial and monetary system, because it is a confidence game. That's what you've been talking about. It's a con game. But still, You know, the morning after the crash, somebody's going to wake up wanting breakfast. And somebody else is going to cook breakfast for them.
Right, and there's no point in waiting for the crash. You might as well start getting good at cooking breakfast now.
That's exactly right. And as long as you do that, there's always going to be a place and security for you in the world. And,
right.
You know, the Great Depression also pointed out another important aspect of wealth and security. And you and I have talked about this before, that in your family and in your community, there is a great deal of security and wealth. When we say a man is wealthy because he has many friends, that's not some sort of metaphor. That's the fact. Because when he gets in trouble and he needs help, or he loses his job, he doesn't have any way to make a living, if he's got a family who will support him until he can get on his feet again, then he has more security than the person who depends on, you know, 26 weeks of unemployment payments.
I always tell the story of when the Department of Justice kind of cut off my cash flow. Mm. I had lent an incredible amount of, or donated an incredible amount of money to my family and friends, and that was the one source of money that couldn't be cut off. And it really kept me alive. I can't fathom what was the best investment I ever made was investing in the people I loved.
Isn't that a little ironic, don't you think?
Well, no, I think that, you know, I think it's a little obvious now. I wasn't brought up to believe that. I was brought up to believe you made your fortune on IBM stock. And it never occurred to me, you know, I just felt that, I've always been a people investor, and the great venture capitalists will tell you they don't invest in businesses, they invest in people. So I've always been a people investor, and I can't explain to you why I invested so much money in the people around me, but thank heavens I did.
Well, again, that's the difference between wealth and money, profits.
Because
the profit of doing that may not have been immediately apparent. And, you know, sometimes you just do things because it's right. But I think we need to put a break on here, or put a caution and a warning in, that when we talk about local investing or investing for wealth and so forth, that we're not talking about senseless investing. We're not talking about just senselessly throwing money at something and saying, oh, well, you know, this is socially productive, or this doesn't hurt the environment, so I'll throw money at this. You still have to invest the personal time and effort to see what the enterprise is and whether or not it can really make money and what the risks of it are. And not only the risks in terms of what the market is and the potential market and the markup and all of that sort of thing, but what are the human risks involved? Does this person who runs this business, does he have what it takes to succeed and build wealth in that area?
One of the reasons that Larry strongly, strongly recommend shifting bank deposits mm-hmm. to local banks, because local banks are still part of the Federal Reserve System, and so, you know, in that sense are arguably still part of the tapeworm.
Mm-hmm.
What I've discovered is a lot of the knowledge about risk and managing financial risk in a community,
mm-hmm.
you find in your good local banks. You've just got a wealth of people who understand, you know, and how to approach business and small business with real discernment.
Well, I think that's true. I think that's threatened, though, by the centralizing mentality that the tapeworm enforces on everyone. You know, the story I told earlier about the two bankers, the brothers who were bankers and invested in the local community and literally enriched everyone around them because they understood wealth, they understood investing for wealth, and they understood using the power of their money the right way. They also did something else. There were obviously poor people in the community. It was a poor area. And those poor people would come in and, you know, maybe it was a mama and her children had moved off to Detroit where they could get a job in the automobile industry. And she'd come in and she'd want a loan to buy a bus ticket to go up and see him. And, these two fellas would, you know, they'd fill out the papers as if they were making her a loan, and they'd give her the money, and then, you know, they'd take the loan application and throw it in the drawer and forget about it because they didn't expect her to pay it back.
Right, and they certainly didn't want the regulators to see that application.
No, well, that was just the problem. You know, they were very sharp businessmen, and they kept an eye on what they did. But it was the kind of little bank. I mean, if you went into it, it was just a little storefront place. And if you, you know, wanted to get into the vault, they couldn't remember where they put the key the last time, that kind of stuff. Well, along come the regulators and the tightening of the regulators, and they don't like that sort of stuff. They're going to stop all that sort of stuff because it doesn't fit the pattern that they've learned. And the fact is, Catherine, other than a few principles of risk assessment and assessing human beings and so forth, there isn't a pattern for building wealth. You know, there's certain principles that we can say, like you have to serve people, you have to be honest, you have to be ruthlessly honest with yourself when you assess markets and what your costs are and so forth. And those are general principles. But as far as making a success out of things, the way people do it is different in every single case.
And you always, you take, and I, this both happened to me when I was on Wall Street or in any business I have, you try 10 things, you put money and time into every one of them, and ultimately you get it back plus 30% or, you know, plus 20%. But it never comes back in any way the way you thought it would, and some things work and some things are a complete bust.
Right.
I mean, we used to see venture capital portfolios on Wall Street where you do 30 investments and you lose money on 28 and two would be so fantastic that you'd get a 30% return on the whole portfolio.
Right.
But it's a little bit like baseball. You got to keep getting up at the plate. You got to keep learning. You got to keep hitting them or striking out. But you got to keep swinging.
Right. And there isn't any single formula for success. There isn't any single formula. It depends on what the circumstances are. It depends on what the abilities of the people, the leaders in the business. All of those things vary from situation to situation. But, you know, what we're pointing out is that a person who's going to take back control of his life, a person who's going to get out from under the tapeworm, a person who's going to pull away from dependence on the federal credit is necessarily going to have to put more effort into these decisions than he ever put in them before.
And it's going to have to get to know what I call the wizard. You know, your two bankers are what I call community wizards.
Mm-hmm.
They're going to have to get to know and learn from the community wizards in their place. Let me, I just want to touch briefly on what I call the export-import capital model we have. Because if you look at my local area from, just as an ecosystem,
mm-hmm.
what's been happening is, we've all been exporting our bank deposits, and we've all been exporting our investments at the same time that we and the businesses in our community and our neighbors have then been importing capital back. So we've allowed the capital flows in our community to be intermediated. We've been allowing global players to get between us and the businesses and our neighbors and intermediate our money in a way that is draining us. And I think that's something that we don't clearly see, the extent to which we're putting our money in all these big global institutions, and then, say, for our mortgage money, we're borrowing back from the very people who have collected up our money.
Well, in some cases, we're almost borrowing back our own money.
Right. I'm putting money in a bank CD at 2-5%, and then my neighbor's borrowing back at 10-30%.
Right.
That's a huge opportunity.
Right.
The other thing I wanted to bring up was, because this will really help you understand how the world could change. Once upon a time, a local bank made mortgage loans in my community. And if anything, if my community started to turn down, if drugs started to come in, they would lose money on the mortgages. And then if I had my deposits in the bank, I could lose my money if the bank got wiped out.
Mm-hmm.
So we all cared that our community was productive and the people in it was productive. Because if everybody wasn't productive, we lose money.
Right.
And so what's the federal credit? Well, the federal credit came along and started to guarantee all the mortgages. And so the federal credit came along and started to guarantee the deposits. So I put money in the bank, and I don't care whether the bank is well-run or not because I've got the federal credit, right?
Right.
I don't worry about that. And then the bank makes all sorts of mortgage loans, and they're guaranteed by the federal credit. So the bank doesn't worry about making money because, in fact, they pull them up and create securities, and they sell those securities to my pension fund.
Mm-hmm.
And so when the federal credit fails, if it fails, what we're going to discover is the bank is fine, and you know, I'll have my deposits, but what I'll discover is my pension fund's been wiped out. My government is bankrupt, and I'm now liable for the debt owned by the creditors all around the world.
Right.
But I will go back to a world where if drugs come into my community and destroy the productivity of that community, I can't not care because I'm protected by the federal credit.
Right, but I think that points out the whole fallacy of thinking that you can get away from responsibility for your own life. See, what you understand what I mean? Because if you say, well, I'm not going to worry about the solvency of my local bank because I've got the FDIC behind it. Well, you and I both know that the FDIC has less than 0.25% of all the deposits in reserve. And
right.
And their form of bailing out banks is bluff. That's,
right.
That's what they do. They go in and bluff until they buy enough time to somehow or the other settle the thing out. Well,
actually, what they've been doing is they've been allowing, because I watched this when I was on the board of Sallie Mae, you know, and Citibank was essentially, had negative equity. It was in the early 90s, and the big conversation of all the vice chairmen of the big banks on the board was, you know, are they going to let Citibank go down? Is it too big to fail? And what happened, Franklin, is something we've seen happen many times since, which was, you know, the Fed made it easy for Citibank to borrow money and then lend it back to us as the, you know, through the U.S. Treasury at a significant profit.
They made them intermediaries.
They
right.
just pumped backdoor profits into Citibank while, you know, the big banks were saying, well, we're not going to loan to small business because it's not as profitable. Well, sure, it's not as profitable as a rigged game. Mm-hmm. And so they literally just pumped pure profit in the, you know, it's the biggest subsidization in the history of Western civilization at the time.
Right. They created a situation where the banks could intermediate and gave them, in essence, a profit. But, you know, Catherine, I don't know if you've ever read the Tennessee Constitution, but it would well repay yourself because we have a wonderful Bill of Rights there. But there's one very interesting thing that it took me a long time to figure out in that Constitution, and that is, It lists three things that can be taxed: merchants, peddlers, and privileges. Merchants, peddlers, and privileges. And you think about it, nothing else is allowed to be taxed. But the thing that really, really messed me up there was merchants. Because I understand privileges, because that's something that the state creates and gives to somebody. So they're entitled to have some kind of pay for that. And
uh-huh.
then peddlers, of course, are people who are from outside the community, so they can't be trusted. Not like, well, you understand, not like a person.
Absolutely. Oh, absolutely.
They're going to be here one day and gone the next. But merchants, I just couldn't figure out why merchants. And it was only later when I was reading a great old Presbyterian theologian, a fellow named Robert Louis Dabney, who wrote in the, well, he lived in the 19th century. And he went into a long disquisition about merchants, and it's hard for us because we don't come from an agricultural and agrarian society to realize this, but merchants were looked on by that society as useless parasites precisely because they did the thing that you're talking about. They
consumption, trade, as well.
Intermediaries. Right.
Right.
They were intermediaries who basically were parasitical. Now, I don't mean that all merchants are parasites, and I don't mean that they thought that, but we're talking about a needless multiplication of merchants. And
right.
the people who wrote the Tennessee Constitution considered that that intermediation was so dangerous to the stability and freedom of society that it had to be controlled by taxation.
That's fascinating.
Isn't it?
Believe it or not, I do have a copy of the Tennessee Constitution. One of the reasons that I created the Solari model was we needed a financial model that would allow us to build financial wealth by reducing consumption. And when you run your economy on equity and not on debt, in fact, that's the case. In other words, the less consumption you have, the more you build up your wealth, the more you build your environment, the more you build your assets. And, of course, we have currently a financial system where the more you consume, the more wealth you create, which, when you think about it, is kind of upside down and backwards and a little bit insane.
But the system is, but that feeds on the system, too, because the system requires the members of the society to keep on going into debt. And they have to go, and they have to go into debt to consume as well.
Right.
So yeah, as long as you use, that's a really brilliant insight, Catherine. I never thought about that. But as long as you use debt financing, and primarily debt and financing instead of equity financing, then you're going to encourage that consuming society.
Right. And the more we encourage people to have high overheads, because one of the greatest ways to build wealth is to just get your overhead way, 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 way down. And I have to thank the Department of Justice for teaching me that lesson, because I had a combined personal and professional overhead of about $1 million a month, and they taught me how to go from $1 million down to $2,000 a month. and my quality of life improves, so, you know, it can be done.
Right.
Well, we're coming up on the hour, so I wanted to remind everyone, if you have questions, to go to the event resource page. There's a link provided, and you can go to the Solari Action Network and post them there. So, well, this is wonderful, Franklin. How did you learn the difference between money and wealth? How did you personally learn this? When did you learn it?
Gosh, Catherine, you shocked me with that question. I hadn't thought about that. I think it's just, you know, maybe it's just by observing part of it. Certainly it was by observing people and by noticing how much more worthy of respect people were who had really made their way in the world and were productive people. I think growing up and in my young manhood, I always had a great admiration for those people who really knew how to do things and how to produce things, as opposed to people who just could buy or hire them done. So I think that's part of it. There's also a great book by Elgin Grossclose called Man and Money, which is a fabulous exploration of that problem through history.
One of the reasons I love sitting, I call it your trading floor, where you have, you know, where you and everybody is sitting around doing the dealership. And the first time I came to your place, and I was sitting on the Franklin Sanders trading floor, the money changer trading floor, somebody, I think it was you or Justin, stood up and said, I think I'll go feed the hogs now. but one of the reasons I love being there is because everyone is so comfortable talking about money. And, you know, there are not many places now in America, you know, on Wall Street you could feel real comfortable talking about money, but I think a lot of us have, you know, think of something as money as different and separate from our lives. And what I've found is a lot of people are really uncomfortable, and you know, there's been so much emotional baggage attached to the notion of money, and we need to come clean in terms of our thinking about money, and we need to feel free to just use money as something that we use again as a tool to build our world.
Right.
And that's, you know, I just love being at the Money Changer, because you all are just, you know, it's whether it's feeding the hogs or shorting, you know, gold, you know, writing puts on gold or what, you know, it's just all part of one flow of stuff.
You know, I think one of the things that annoys me the most about the modern world is the professionalization and mystification of everything.
Uh-huh.
You know, after all, for centuries and centuries, until memory runneth not to the contrary, women had children with midwives. You know, they had babies by midwives.
Uh-huh.
And suddenly everything is mystified and professionalized, and what happens is our development and our learning and the growth of our wisdom is truncated because we're told, oh, you can't do that yourself, you have to turn that over to a professional. And,
uh-huh.
And what that does is it compartmentalizes your life so that, you know, the money stuff is over here, and that has nothing to do with the integrity stuff over here or the morality stuff over here or, you know, the fun stuff over yonder. And, it, you know, the professional money manager will make thing, make it appear as if, oh, you poor child, I know you think you can handle these things, but you're really not capable of doing it. Well, if I'm the one that got together the $500,000 in the first place, don't you think I've got enough sense to know how it ought to be managed now?
Okay, are you ready for questions?
Sounds good to me.
Okay, let's go. One of our questions here is, how much of my assets should I have as liquid assets, and how much should I have as illiquid assets? How do I think about that?
Well, I think one way you can think about it is what your needs are. And, of course, you know, there's liquidity is not – liquidity exists on a spectrum, and some things are very, very illiquid, like real estate, and some things are less illiquid but still not as liquid as having cash. But I think you have to think about what your needs are. And you always ought to have liquid at least 3 months of your cash needs there close by. And then you move your time horizon out farther and farther and farther. If you've got a child who's in college and you're trying to pay $10,000 or $20,000 worth of tuition a year, well, obviously you need that to be liquid. So you have to look at what your time horizon is to figure out what your liquidity, how much liquidity you need.
Okay, now, how much, another question I'm going to just reformulate it. How much of your assets would you recommend someone put in local venture versus precious metals? Where does precious metals fit into this?
Well, I think one of the things that you have to learn, have to realize about precious metals is that they're basically cash. And they're, you know, when you buy those, the return that you expect to make off of them is a capital gain. It's like buying a stock. It's a stock that doesn't pay dividends, so you're not expecting to have your investment returned from a dividend. You're expecting to have it returned from whatever the price appreciation is. So that really, that gold and silver is part of your liquidity, and it ought to be. I know that. It's long-term in the sense that we expect that it's going to have greater and greater returns over the next decade, but still it's part of your liquidity as well, because it can be, it is cash. It's the ultimate cash. So I think it ought to be lumped in together with your liquidity. As far as what percentage you want, my problem in recommending these fixed percentages is that I look at the future and I see a very, very poor future for most other investments. I see a very poor future for stocks, a very poor future for bonds, a very poor future for any U.S. dollar-denominated assets. And so I tend to move away from the so-called prudent man ideas and go toward those things that I think will really weather what I expect to be an economic storm over the next 10 years or so. And that means great liquidity, like silver and gold. Now, I think they'll perform very well. But it also means before that, your own personal source of revenue. And that may be a small business. You know, if you work for somebody, then that's going to be whatever your personal abilities are, your personal capital in yourself. Those are the things that I would want the greatest investment in. And of course,
now, the dollar's been holding steady this year, and you've been one of the people who predicted that would happen. So you've been very wise on that. When do you think the dollar's going to start falling again?
I think probably from here we have another 6 or probably more likely 12 months of dollar strength. As long as you have to separate the short term from the long term. In the long term, all of those fundamental problems that you and I see with the dollar, for instance, the deficit in the balance of payments, the fact that we import more, that we buy abroad more than we sell to foreigners, the U.S. dollar, the United States government deficit in their budget, the war in Iraq, which of course increases that budget, all of these problems mean that we look at the dollar and we say, wow, fundamentally the dollar is in really bad shape and ought to drop. And that's absolutely true. But fundamental things don't work themselves out in the next 6 months or 12 months. They
right.
will. They will at some point. But it's very much, you know, and I know that the public perception, it determines the value of a stock. I mean, I've seen gold and silver stocks, and I've looked at their balance sheet and their operations and their prospects, and I've thought to myself, why in the world would anybody buy this thing? And yet it goes, you know, it goes shooting up. I've seen silver stocks, for instance. There are not many silver stocks. One that's known as a silver producer is Hecla. Well, 10 or 12 years ago, Hecla was not making 15% of their revenue from silver. So it wasn't really a silver company. Now, that's changed in the last 15 years. But see, because they had a reputation as a silver company, people would invest in them. And it's the same way with currencies. You know, in the short term, the fact that the U.S. dollar has a positive interest rate differential with the euro, that is, the dollar pays more interest short term than the euro does. That attracts people to the dollar. It's just that simple.
Right.
And then that begins to feed on itself. And, you know, back in December, everybody in the world was certain that the dollar was going to go to zero. And so they had all sold dollars. Well, then technically that creates a situation where the dollar is very severely oversold. And there are all these people who are short dollars. And as the price, there's nobody left to sell. And then as the price starts turning around and going back up, at some point those people get scared because they start losing money. They panic out of the dollar and boom, 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 then that sends it up in great big giant steps. So that's what we're dealing with now. We're dealing with a short-term situation where the dollar is correcting against its long fall. The fundamentals are going to reassert themselves, obviously, in the dollar, and it will continue to go down. It will continue to lose value, like the 30% value it lost between in the 3 years between 2002 and the end of 2004. So
sounds like a dangerous time to have any debt.
Well, it's a dangerous time to have debt because the dollar's climbing. And,
right.
And people still have this idea that that the dollar's going to drop imminently. Well, it's not. It's still got another, as I said, 6 to 12 months.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Franklin. I think, in summary, it's fair to say we're talking about moving from a political economy where the federal credit really, you know, makes things tick on a political basis to a fundamental economy where we're back to basics. So it's another way of saying it is we're moving from a world where financial assets have value to something where a world where real assets have value.
Right. I think there's something else too, though. I think that you're talking very much about personal sovereignty and reclaiming sovereignty over your own life. You know, we will see more and more of that as well.
Right. Absolutely. And to me, part of that is taking political action. You know, I have to make another pitch. If you're banking at one of the big banks, move your deposits local, because it all starts, you know, you start to re-engineer the money by getting it down to a level, decentralizing enough so people can start to take personal sovereignty. So I gotta make my pitch for moving your deposits local. Okay, well, we have a wonderful invocation from our spiritual, our Soleri prayer team leader, Ileana Obadiah. So, Ileana, can I invite you to close us in invocation?
Catherine, thank you, and thank you, Franklin. I've learned so much here tonight. It's such a blessing in the way that you present information for people to just absorb and take in for true transformation. So this is our time when we just spend a couple of minutes tapping into the goodness and wisdom of the divine that lives inside of us all the time and can guide us in practical ways to begin to apply the things that we've learned. So we begin now tonight just by giving thanks for the true wealth that is already in our lives, whatever form that is for you and your family and your community. Just give thanks that we have now tools that we can work with to help create a culture together that really is an integration of the divine into everyday life, just as Franklin said. We give thanks that we have the opportunity to build community, to build real wealth in a truly productive society that supports and honors everybody's gifts. And we know that the best kind of capital we have, the greatest wealth that we can ever have, is in ourselves and our desire and ability to serve one another. Might just tap into that divine resource right now so that we can learn to look at the world around us in wonder, but also with clear eyes and a sense of responsibility, that we can reclaim the sovereignty back into our lives to become responsible, aware creators of wealth. We'll just take a moment to think about forms of wealth that are in your life, that are in your own talents, in the bonds of love that you share with others in the world. Good evening, everyone. Have a wonderful night.